Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. South Sudan has testing kits for the deadly coronavirus. And prison authorities in Juba struggle to care for inmates with mental illness. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has opened a special laboratory to test any suspected cases of the corona disease as the disease intensifies around the world with several cases reported in four African countries. World Health Organization and the Ministry of Health officials say South Sudan will no longer have to send samples to neighboring countries for testing. David Monodanga reports for VOA from Juba.
In a proactive effort to prevent coronavirus or COVID-19 from reaching South Sudan, health officials say the newly opened laboratory has the proper equipment and medical staff trained to deal with an outbreak of the virus and can test up to 1,000 samples a day. Laboratory technician Philip Katchok describes how the laboratory operates in what he calls the red zone area.
What we have here is what I call personally the magic box. It has a name, it's called the glove box. It's actually used for containment of highly infectious pathogens. What do we mean by non-infectious pathogens? Hemorrhagic fever, for example, Ebola, Marburg, dengue, and etc. So these pathogens cannot be contained under the regular biosafety level of 2 or 1. They need a special containment.
The biosafety levels, Katjok refers to, are a series of protections relegated to biological labs. They are individual safeguards designed to protect laboratory personnel as well as the surrounding environment and community. These levels, which are ranked from 1 to 4, are selected based on the agents or organisms that are being researched. James Ayei, manager of the primary health laboratory, says the country has been ready to counter an outbreak since last month when the specialized equipment arrived from Geneva.
We have developed these SOPs that can be used for coronavirus. We developed it since last month, the day 24, when we receive our primers from Geneva, and we are ready here to do our testing for corona in South Sudan. But obviously now there is no suspected cases in South Sudan.
According to the World Health Organization, there are now almost 90,000 cases of coronavirus reported worldwide in about 70 countries, although the vast majority remain in China and most of those are in Hubei province, where the virus originated late last year. Dr. Gurasha Guyo, WHO's emergency coordinator for South Sudan, says the facilities the ministry installed to deal with the Ebola virus has put South Sudan in a better position to contain coronavirus.
This laboratory here is part of a network of referral laboratories. Remember that. Samples, we can always send samples to Uganda, to Kenya. You know, they work closely, intertwined. So if the samples increases, then resources will also increase. We think this for now it's adequate.
Dr. Guyo says the virus appears to particularly affect those over the age of 60 and people already ill. He advises people to frequently wash their hands with soap and avoid spitting and coughing in public places. Dr. Makur Koryom, Undersecretary in the National Health Ministry, says the government and its partners are working to ensure the coronavirus disease does not enter the country, but worries oil workers who travel from China straight to oil fields in Unity and Upper Nile states may unknowingly carry the virus. Dr. Koryom says special scanners were installed at the Juba airport to screen travelers entering the country.
The team are working also in Numeli to install, or rather have installed, a similar equipment. Work is ongoing to have similar equipment in Yambio and Wau, where we also receive international flights. We are also very much wary about oil workers in areas of College and Unity State. And similar measures are being taken also in those places, because at times oil workers fly into the country, and right from Juba International Airport, they connect straight to those places.
Corium says South Sudan cannot suspend flights to or from the COVID-19 affected countries, but says people should have to practice personal discipline by isolating themselves when they feel symptoms of flu, common cold, or cough. More than 3,000 people have died globally from COVID-19, according to the World Health Organization. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
South Sudan prison officials want the government to move inmates with mental problems to hospitals where they can get specialized treatments. Juba prison official says housing mentally ill prisoners is counterproductive because the conditions in the prisons are very harsh. Ding Magot has more for VOA from Juba.
50-year-old Rasul Genere Ajibe visited her 26-year-old Elizaya Manga at the Juba Central Prison, who was brought to the facility after being diagnosed with mental problems in Juba Teaching Hospital. Speaking in Arabic, Ajibe says her son was violent at home.
On November 1st, 2019, he broke all the doors and windows in the house, and on the same day, when I was still asleep, he came and attacked me and held my neck. I started crying and his brother came and helped the situation out. So since then, I decided to that if we leave him in this situation here, he could kill someone.
Dr. James Ball, a clinical officer in charge of Juba Central Prison, says even though there is a ward for the mentally ill at Juba Teaching Hospital, some of the mentally ill are brought to prison because they are violent.
The wild people, we normally keep them here because they will not have access to fight with their relative. There inside the prison, we have got two. We have got Ward 7 and Ward 8. Ward 8, this is a battered one.
Dr. Ball says psychiatrists from Juba Teaching Hospital often visit mentally ill inmates at the Juba Central Prison every Tuesday and Friday. Taban Christopher Laku, the deputy director of Juba Central Prison, says prison guards are not trained on how to handle mentally ill people.
Those who are mentally sick are supposed to be removed from prison to the hospital, because there is a right place for them, not the prison. Because as a prison personnel, we don't train how to deal with those who are mentally ill.
Laku says prison guards are also not trained on dispensing medications for the mentally ill. General Henry Kwan Aguar, Director General of the South Sudan National Prison Service, says Juba Central Prison is extremely overcrowded with 1,330 inmates and no facilities for the mentally ill.
Mentally ill are 44 in number. They are arrested without charges, and there are nobody taking care of them. They remain inside there until they die, one by one. And when they become sick, we take them to the teaching hospital for treatment.
Florian Seriex, public relations for the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, in South Sudan, says there is a general lack of facilities in South Sudan and much more needs to be done for the people with mental illness.
Those who are mentally sick are supposed to be removed from prison to the hospital, because there is a right place for them, not the prison. Because as a prison personnel, we don't train how to deal with those who are mentally ill.
Dr. Tong Ayuel, Director for the Mental Health Department at the National Health Ministry and the head of the psychiatric unit at Juba Teaching Hospital, the only facility in South Sudan which tests mental illness, says some families prefer taking their relatives to prison due to the stigma attached to mental illness.
The government is building a hospital with the help of the Indian government, a psychiatric hospital where there will be a secure cells to treat the mental ill offenders.
Ayuel says once the psychiatric hospital is built, it should be easy to transfer mentally ill inmates from the prison to the facility. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
More than 1 week after the country's five vice presidents were sworn in, the parties have yet to appoint a cabinet. The main parties, President Salva Kiir's SPLM in government and the SPLM in opposition, led by Riek Machar, are deadlocked over the allocation of ministerial portfolios. A Juba-based analyst says the delays point to a rough road ahead. Wake Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Peter Mayen Majongdit, leader of a coalition called the Other Political Parties, or OPP, which signed the Revitalized Peace Agreement, says the delay for appointing the new cabinet revolves around President Kiir and Machar.
The committee, which is the political committee that was dealing with the allocation of ministerial positions, were able to reach consensus with the OPP. They were able to reach consensus with the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, but they definitely reached a deadlock with the SPLM-IO, and the deadlock is about the ministerial positions.
Following the swearing-in of the five vice presidents 2 Saturdays ago, the parties to the agreement began negotiations on how to divide up the ministerial portfolios. Majongdit says while OPP and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, OSAWA, reached a deal with Kiir's party on which ministries to run the SPLM-IO was not on board. The revitalized peace deal allocated 20 ministries to Kiir's party, 9 ministries to Machar's party, 3 ministries to the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, 3 ministries to the former detainees, and 1 ministry to the other political parties. The agreement did not specify which ministries each party would run, although it is unclear which ministries the parties are squabbling about. Social media reports suggest the deadlock between the SPLM-IO and the SPLM in government is over the defense, finance, petroleum, and interior ministries. A source who spoke on condition of anonymity because he is not authorized to speak to the media says Sudanese Sovereign Council member Mohamed Hamdan Daglo arrived in Juba yesterday to try to broker a deal. Aside from disputes over who will run the country's various ministries, Majongdit says the parties have yet to discuss the allocation of states.
We have not yet even opened that chapter as per now, but already there is some sort of understanding, a little going on. Every party, among the parties themselves, but it has not yet officially opened up to discuss the which state should go to which one.
James Okuk, a political analyst and a senior research fellow at the Juba-based Center for Strategic and Policy Studies, says that the delay in allocating who will run the states and the dispute over ministers highlights the mistrust between the two parties.
The delay is caused by inabilities of the parties to trust themselves and to look at each other as partners who are supposed to work together, regardless of which ministry or which portfolio each of them is holding. They are not partners as the agreement would like them to be.
Okuk says perhaps Dagalo will make a difference in breaking the logjam.
But this is also a negative indication that the implementation of the revitalized agreement will not go on smoothly without serious
pressure from the neighbors, from the region, and from the international community at large. If those parties are left alone, they will never move South Sudan forward with an inch.
Officials with both President Kiir's and Machar's parties said the leaders were too busy to comment at the time and were engaged in meetings. Repeated calls to former Information Minister Michael Makuei went unanswered. Makuei is on a President Kiir's committee negotiating with the opposition over ministerial portfolios. Calls to Angelina Teny, a senior member of the SPLMIO, and Peter Manawa, the SPLMIO's deputy spokesperson, were unsuccessful. Majongdit says the SPLMIO and the ruling party must reach an agreement soon.
All of us, we are really disturbed, given the fact that the undersecretaries are now running the ministries, and we do not really have a complete government now in power. So this one is we really disturbed, and we really wanted to make sure that the government is formed as soon as possible, so that at least we move to other step, because all this also affect the timelines and of the implementation of the agreement itself.
Undersecretaries have been running the ministries ever since Kiir dissolved the former 32 states nearly 2 weeks ago and agreed to return to the original 10 states plus 3 administrative areas. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudan government removes restrictions on non-governmental organizations operating in Darfur.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands. That is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay at work.
So I think I will go technology any day, any time. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers, so for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing, because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice, so I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudan has removed restrictions on charities working in the country, especially in the Darfur, Kordofan, and the Nuba Mountains areas. The step is welcomed by non-governmental organizations. Authorities say it is important to sustain peace in the country for the more than 2 million displaced residents due to the conflict. Naba Mohyadin has details from Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities say that all obstacles that ousted government of Omar al-Bashir put in place to obstruct the work of humanitarian organizations and United Nations agencies have been removed. In a statement Friday, the head of Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission, Abbas Fadlullah, said Sudan has opened the door wide for the return of all international humanitarian organizations that were expelled during the era of the former regime. They include organizations like the World Food Program and the World Health Organization. Under the new rules, international aid agencies no longer have to get permissions from the General Intelligence Service, GIS, and military intelligence to operate in the country. Notifying the Humanitarian Aid Commission is sufficient. Authorities will also halt their inspections of aid agency operations. Ayman al-Badri, director of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization in Sudan, says he is happy to see the restrictions lifted. He says it's also important and a turning point, especially in observing and following up field work. He says organizations have funds from donors who want to see where the money is spent and who is benefiting it, and that can only be implemented through access to these locations. Previously, many organizations relied on Sudan's government reports or executive agencies, which had a lack of credibility. He says now there is a chance for more credibility. Aid agencies are especially eager to access Darfur, where the Bashir government fought rebel groups for years. At one time, more than 2 million people were displaced from their homes. 23-year-old Mawadda Yagub lives in the Zamzam camp for displaced people. She says the return of aid agencies will make a difference. Mawadda says getting non-governmental organizations back to work in Darfur is so important for internally displaced people like her, especially in the camp she lives in, where previously aid workers were harassed by the former regime and NGOs couldn't work well. Now, if they come back, people will have the humanitarian aid needed. Officials say the decision is part of ongoing peace talks between the traditional government and rebel groups in South Sudan's capital, Juba. The sides are hoping to reach a final peace agreement to stabilize Sudan and allow the country to access international funding for the first time in years. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
A report submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council finds women with albinism and mothers of children with albinism suffer disproportionately from discrimination and stigmatization. The genetic disorder is most prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Ikponwosa Ero, a Nigerian activist who is herself an albino, became the Human Rights Council's first independent expert on the enjoyment of human rights by persons with albinism in 2015. She has done much to eliminate pernicious myths surrounding albinism. Her new report describes excessive abuse and discrimination women with albinism or mothers of children with albinism suffer because of their gender. She says women are abandoned by their families. Mothers of children with albinism are blamed for their condition and often banished from their communities. She says women with albinism are physically attacked and accused of witchcraft. She says they suffer sexual violence on various grounds, including the belief that such intercourse can cure HIV/AIDS.
Mothers of children with a condition are stigmatized right from the birth of their child with albinism and throughout life. Major barriers to access to health ostracize these mothers and expose them and their children to poverty and further human rights violations.
Albinism is a rare genetic disorder characterized by the complete or partial absence of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes. It is particularly prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. Those with the condition often are killed for their parts, which some believe can transmit magical powers. Such beliefs are widespread in countries such as Tanzania, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. ERA wants countries to act to end racial discrimination and institute policies to end harmful practices, particularly those centered on accusations of witchcraft and ritual attacks against women with albinism. She says special programs should be put into place to help these women and their children out of poverty through training so they can earn an independent living. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Africa's most matured economy, South Africa, is in recession following two consecutive quarters of falling GDP. That decline puts Nigeria, long thought to be the continent's second largest economy, into first place with two quarters of growth. South Africa's woes can be largely attributed to struggles with the parastatal energy provider, Eskom, to the bigger global trends, according to experts. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The figures only confirmed what many South Africans, beset by high unemployment and unreliable electricity, already knew. The economy is flagging. This week, the nation's statistical agency announced that the gross domestic product had shrunk by 1.4% in the fourth quarter of 2019. That means two consecutive quarters of contraction, making this officially, for the third time in the history of democratic South Africa, a recession. Economist Laura Hodes of Investec Bank explained.
Multiple domestic challenges persist, notably the security of electricity supply, with heightened rotational load shedding impeding the optimal functioning of the economy. Additionally, persistent policy uncertainty and the slow implementation of crucial reforms continue to weigh on business and consumer confidence, inhibiting satisfactory growth.
Finance Minister Tito Mboweni promised in his annual budget speech, presented last week, that better times are ahead. He identified the nation's electricity provider, Eskom, which has failed to keep up with demand and has had to implement rolling blackouts in recent weeks, as a priority.
We forecast that the South African economy will grow by 0.9% and inflation will average 4.5% in 2020. Over the next 18 months, the economy should get a number of jump starts. Persistent electricity problems will, however, hold back growth. Over the next 3 years, we expect growth to average just over 1%. Therefore, a stable supply of electricity will be our number one critical task.
7 out of 10 of the nation's biggest industries contracted in the fourth quarter, with agriculture falling the most by nearly 8%. Mboweni also attributed the economic situation to the spread of the novel coronavirus, which originated in China in late 2019 and has since infected more than 91,000 people worldwide. While South African officials have yet to report a confirmed case of the virus, Hodes acknowledged that it has hurt the economy.
SA is a small open economy and therefore it is highly sensitive to global events. Although we do not know the extent of the economic damage COVID-19 will cause, as it depends on how quickly the virus is contained, it is currently weighing significantly on global markets.
Meanwhile, however, one of the few African nations that has seen at least one confirmed case of coronavirus is thriving economically. New figures from Nigeria show that the oil giant beat its fourth quarter growth forecasts, making it Africa's biggest economy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That report by Anita Powell from Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Panda Book by Joel Nyal. We've been listening to Joel Nyal with the song Panda Book. I'm John Tanz in Washington. We appreciate you tuning in. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And Jima and Tina Lichaki Adukit.
Chinali chara na cheto.
En juma an chinali cha kia dukit.
Chinali chara na cheto.
En juma an chinali cha kia dukit.
Chinali chara na cheto.
En juma an chinali cha kia dukit.
Chinali chara na cheto.
En juma an chinali cha kia dukit.
Chinali chara na cheto. En juma an chinali cha kia.